You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast on WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today is the second part of our two-part interview with Ray Long, who's a veteran Springfield and Illinois state government reporter who wrote a new book about former state party chair, Democratic state party chair, and former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. The book's called The House That Madigan Built, The Record Run of Illinois' Velvet Hammer. And I will repeat this as I did in the first interview, just for full disclosure, I had worked for Mike Madigan for a very brief period of time back in the late 1980s, and I don't think it affects the objectivity of my questions or statements, but I want to move to the second part of our interview. The first part, which we aired last week, talked about some of the governmental work that Mike Madigan did over the years, how his reputation began, and some specific issues. This time we'll look at some more of the political angle here on Madigan. So, Ray, thanks again for taking some time to talk here twice.
Good to be here. Very good to be here. I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Well, my first question is, you know, how, you know, this guy's been around for a long time, and it included his being speaker when the Republicans drew the map. For our listeners, again, every 10 years, we just went through this process. One party or the other gets to draw a map in Illinois, and it comes down to power. And the Republicans in the 1990s drew the map. How in the world did Mike Madigan, was he able to win a Republican map after first losing it?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is he worked like crazy and had his candidates work like crazy. And the other thing was that Madigan identified that the southern suburbs of Chicago had been going Democratic, that there had been a lot of people moving out of the city and going into the suburbs, and they were turning in about six different legislative districts. They were starting to tilt toward Democrats. So they put on a full court press, and they were able to win back the House after he lost it in 94. He held it for the first map. What they do is they start the new map in the second year, like, for example, 82, 92, etc. And so this was 92. He won. The Republicans drew the map. He won that. He was able to hold it, but it was very close. Then, of course, that had the Clinton first-time election, which helped voter turnout then. And then he lost in 94, which was the time that Newt Gingrich was pushing for the Contract for America. And then Republicans won every statewide office in Illinois that year, and the Republicans won the House that year. So Lee Daniels became Speaker, and Mike Madigan was booted back to Minority Leader. Well, then they started focusing on this demographic change, and they were able to, again, take advantage of Clinton running in 96, and they were able to win those six seats in the southern suburbs that helped them come out. And he ended up with a 60-58 majority that year after the 1996 election. So he was able to win it back after losing it for 2 years, and just poured a big effort into it and raised lots of funds, etc. And I think that when Democrats and trial lawyers and others who supported Democratic issues saw some of the changes that the Republicans made while they were in control, they decided they needed to double down too, and Madigan took advantage of all those factors.
Yeah, because when I first learned about Illinois politics, and you'll remember this, Ray, when we first met back in the 80s, the suburbs and collar counties were pretty Republican. Chicago was Democratic, and downstate was up for grabs. We had Democrats representing districts obviously the Quad Cities and Peoria, the cities, but also some of the rural districts, including in Effingham and places in southern Illinois where it's deep red. Along with that suburban shift to the Democrats, downstate went heavily to the Republicans.
Right, and it's been a gradual shift. You've seen those Democratic districts fall by the wayside over the years here. So, you know, we used to have, like you said, Effingham, Carlisle, Centralia areas, all the way down to the tip of southern Illinois. But most of those seats now are now Republican. And even seats up into central Illinois, like there was a big swath of territory that Bill Edley back in the day won for Democrats, and he was a guy who went out and followed the Madigan plan. He knocked on more than 10,000 doors and went from place to place and won the seat. And that held for a while too, but now those are Republican areas too.
We may be getting a little off the topic of your book, but I guess it does relate to it, because you made a point of reminding me in the book about a very important point about Mike Madigan, which I had always heard about him. He's very well read, and he researches issues quite a bit. And you referenced, I remember the famous issue from back in those days, the mega hog farm issue, that he became very knowledgeable about.
Right, right. And that was an issue that they needed to try to hammer out, to try to address a local issue that was becoming a major issue among more rural areas in the state. And they worked on that, and I think they finally came to a conclusion when George Ryan became governor. But Madigan worked with the folks who needed changes too, so he was sensitive to the local issues that got people elected, because it all added up. His number one thing was to hold the majority so he would remain speaker, and you have to have every person you can get. You don't want to lose seats if you can save them.
You bring up a great point in your book that I wonder it doesn't hold larger lessons for Democrats now, because one of the keys to his success, and you point this out, is in a quote. Madigan says, "I don't use an adjective when I describe my political party. I'm a Democrat." He shunned labels, and he put winning above ideology. And he implemented that, basically, in that he was able, and perhaps that's part of an explanation for his longevity.
Yeah, I think it really is. Because if you step back and say, what did he really push hard, you might, on his own personal agenda, you might be hard-pressed to find, the five big topics that he pushed because he wanted them himself. But he was able to identify what issues were important to his overall caucus, the Democratic troops that worked in the House. And as a result, he was able to shift positions when he had to. Another one of the points, though, from that, and I think that quote that you said was very telling, where he said that he didn't use conservative or moderate or liberal when he described himself as a Democrat. I think that gave him a lot of flexibility by doing that, by looking at it like that. And he could shift when the overall issues were, when the people were shifting on their positions of the issue. One of the things that struck me, too, was that he was able to see how to forge compromise to get things done, because of that flexibility. And what I'm talking about is when the federal court, federal appellate court, ordered Illinois to have concealed carry for guns because it was the last state that did not allow that. Madigan sat down in a room with the proponents of the issue and the opponents of the issue, and they tried to hammer out something that would work. And he found that, you know, he used the practical realities of an issue like that that had to be resolved. And I think he applied those same kind of realities when he came up with issues that were good for his caucus.
There was always a story going around, and this may be told, of Madigan's sense of how fast to move on change. But there was always a story I heard that Mike Madigan, and this sounds counterintuitive to a lot of our listeners perhaps, but he did not want Democrats to have a supermajority because he wanted them, to have a majority and keep him as Speaker. But he didn't want a supermajority perhaps because he didn't want to move too fast on any social issues, especially that might put his caucus out of step with prevailing public opinion. Was there anything like that that you picked up on over the years?
Well, that's the kind of thing that I heard, but I've never really been able to press the Speaker on that point. I do remember that they were never really excited about, they never seemed to be excited about getting a supermajority until it really cost them back in the Rauner administration when they were trying to push through a couple of pieces of legislation. They escape me right now, but they needed a supermajority to override Rauner vetoes, and they, I believe, needed a supermajority to help pass whatever it was they wanted, or at least they felt that they needed the supermajority because they'd eventually have to beat back a veto. And there was a guy named Ken Duncan from Chicago who had aligned himself with Rauner and as a result had not stayed on the Democratic side on these issues. And after that, they went out and got a supermajority. Now, it could have been part of the reason that happened, could have been because they felt they needed to get that supermajority to beat back a governor whose ideologies were definitely different than the Democrats. Or it could be that the shape of the electorate also helped them do it without necessary tug and pull to get there. But the reality is that they went out and got a supermajority once they really saw the value of it.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm enjoying a conversation, an extended conversation, with veteran reporter Ray Long, who's worked over the years covering Illinois state government and politics. He's currently with the Chicago Tribune. And we're talking about Ray's recent book concerning former House Speaker Mike Madigan, who everybody knows now. The book is called The House That Madigan Built. And, it's interesting because the theory on Madigan and the rumors going around over the years, he would never get caught doing anything that would take him down. He was too careful. He was too structured. He was too disciplined. But here we are. He's under indictment. It seemed like, and you detail in your book, the start of his downfall, where he became a household name with just millions of dollars in negative ads. But I'm sure you had heard that as well, but did he leave himself exposed a little bit here, which could be his downfall here, or was he careful enough and it was his underlings that perhaps were a little sloppy?
Well, I do think that he lost control maybe of some of the people who were around him. But I also know that, he and his troops or acolytes or allies always swore up and down that he never crossed the lines. And, of course, he drew the lines, a lot of the lines anyway. But also, The federal indictment that is hanging over him now certainly rebuffs that, if not, allegedly refutes it, and says actually that he did cross the lines on various things from, trying to cut deals that would help him financially and also help others in his political sphere.
It's interesting, and you point this out, that he's putting together a defense at this point, and it's pretty early. This trial will probably drag on, this whole process, but he's putting together kind of an old ward healer defense, which is what he grew up with under his dad and Mayor Daley, the first Mayor Daley. If he was just trying to help his friends get jobs and contracts. He even invoked a famous former Illinois president. I mean, maybe kind of discuss for our listeners what his defense is specifically, and perhaps your thoughts on, we'll see whether it has legs or not.
Right. He basically says that, there's no harm in making recommendations for jobs. But the question is whether the recommendations were actually recommendations or they were commands. And I believe the federal folks are going to say that he did a lot more than simply make recommendations for jobs, and that he commanded a large patronage army, and that they eventually have said or alleged in the indictment that he was requiring or asking or demanding jobs of some of his cronies to be hired at Commonwealth Edison. And Commonwealth Edison has acknowledged that they put people on the payroll in hopes of winning Madigan's favorable eye when it came to their legislative packages. And they were quite successful as a utility, too. So there's the argument that he never crossed the lines, and there's the allegations that he did.
And he even invokes Abe Lincoln. That's interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, I believe the Abe Lincoln, one of the legal briefs by some of the defendants has said, look, even Abe Lincoln tried to help out somebody during the Civil War, went out and reached out. So there are a variety of arguments that are going to be thrown out there, and he's already spent $8 million from his campaign war chest to put together a legal or paid that to the law firm that he has working for him. So it's going to be, it looks like it has all the makings anyway of a robust defense.
He really, we can take the rest of our time on the interview here and talk a little bit about just looking back at his overall legacy. But one of the things that stands out to me as a lifelong Illinoisan is he really got to see the best of politics and the worst of politics in some of our governors. I mean, whether our listeners are Democrats or Republicans, the story of Barack Obama's rise from his childhood to become president of the United States is a quintessential American story. But then he had to deal with Rod Blagojevich as well. That's kind of going on each end of the extreme, and you detail both in the book. Were there any lessons or interesting stories out of that that you can share a little bit?
Well, I think that Madigan and Obama had some détente, if you will. I do recall early on that Obama was gaining momentum and getting more recognition, et cetera, and that the speaker had told a reporter that, to write down that he's the Messiah, or he said something derogatorily saying that he's the Messiah. He didn't mean it as a compliment, but over the years then he saw Obama rise and got on the train and actually eventually moved up the date for the primary from March to February so that it would help Obama in his quest of racking up the delegates early in the presidential election in 2008. Eventually, Madigan did propose $100 million of state money to be put into the Obama center up here in Chicago, but not all that materialized. But he also did things like say that Obama's picture should be up on the wall in the House instead of Stephen A. Douglas, who has been there for decades, with on one side of the chamber, on the Democratic side of the chamber, and Abraham Lincoln on the other. It's a recognition or a nod to the Lincoln-Douglas debates that were so famous, but as a result of recent research, Madigan cited concerns about some of Douglas's positions over the years and suggested that Obama be put up there as the painting instead of Douglas. But all those things could play into how he was always trying to keep the African American Black Caucus on his side too. So even when he lost the speakership, he had the Black Caucus in his corner, all but one member out of a group of about 24 lawmakers, and he clearly was always trying to do things to help out the caucus if he could. So that there's a lot of nuance into his relationship with Obama. Obama, interestingly, came to the Illinois House and gave an address about how we need to clean up redistricting here so that it would be less partisan. And Madigan, of course, was one of the most partisan craftsmen when it came to redrawing the district lines. As far as Rod Blagojevich goes, the guy was as much of a disaster as you've probably heard. He really didn't show that much interest in the basic role of government, and he didn't always follow the you know, there's some basic rules that you have to follow, and he didn't seem to worry about that too much. Some of the stuff was you know, good, sounded good, but it didn't follow the law. Like, you know, why don't we import drugs from other countries because they're cheaper there, but it didn't comport with federal law. He also tried to bring in some flu vaccine from, I believe it was Europe, and that was never allowed to be used in Illinois, but he was trying to get the bill paid for too, and they got into a dispute over that, and he eventually sent the drugs over to Pakistan, and by that time they were expired in Pakistan. Didn't use them either. Of course, one of the things Madigan really was viewed as the adult in the room when Blagojevich won the governorship, and Madigan kind of kept him from going wild on spending, and also prevented some prisons from being closed and a variety of other things. But one of the things that's most memorable is that in their, I believe it was their second budget standoff in the spring of 2004, there was a lack of trust by lawmakers that Blagojevich would do what he said he would do, even when the budget was passed. So the governor has the ultimate release of a lot of the funds, and the lawmakers didn't think that he was going along with what he had promised to put into their districts. And so They had about two dozen written agreements that were kind of side letters to the budget that said, Blagojevich, you're actually going to do what you said you were going to do here in sending these funds. It was a really remarkable show that there was a lack of trust of Governor Blagojevich. And yet the speaker still came back and endorsed him for re-election in 2006, even though the feds were crawling all over the administration by then. And, then when Blagojevich got arrested, Madigan led the impeachment. So, you know, there's all kinds of sides to that equation, too.
Yeah. We only have like a minute left, and I'm going to ask a tough question to if you can respond in just a minute. Madigan's got a complicated legacy. He's been there a long time. Some say he's underperformed. Some say he's held the state together moving forward. What do you think, just in a short, quick answer, what's his legacy, or is it yet to be written?
Well, I think his legacy is going to really depend a lot on what happens in this trial. He's facing a 22-count indictment, ranging from bribery-related counts to racketeering. And, if he gets acquitted, that will help his legacy, obviously. But if he gets indicted, he'll go down as a crooked politician in Illinois.
Ray, this has been really a pleasure for me talking to you here in, again, two shows, the first time I've done this, about your book. For our listeners, this is an even-handed book. Ray doesn't, I think he's fair and objective in his treatment of the speaker. We've touched on some of the topics. There's quite a few others in here, including his complicated relationship with his daughter, which we didn't touch on, which is fascinating. There's several other topics I think listeners would find interesting, and like all good books, examining parts of people's lives, it's a great history of our state, of our politics and government over the last 50 years. So, Ray, I just want to thank you again for being our guest on Heartland Politics. Again, this book is called The House That Madigan Built, The Record Run of Illinois' Velvet Hammer. And Ray Long's the author. Ray, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me on twice.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at wvik.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.